Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, you know what we haven't talked about so far in the show in almost 100 episodes that I think impacts every EB5 investor and the EB5 industry as a whole? Taxation.
That's one area which people try to avoid, but you're absolutely right, Mark. Taxation is something which is really, really important when it comes to EB5, unlike many of the other areas in U.S. immigration. Prior to this episode, I did do a little research, and I think some of the statistics that I came up with was very interesting. According to Forbes, the United States has the most billionaires in the world. And according to CNBC, we have a record number of millionaires here. The U.S. also has a distinction of being one of only two countries in the world that has what's called citizenship-based taxation, i.e. one must file U.S. income taxes regardless of where he or she lives or earns income. And although I mentioned the word citizenship, the taxation element does come in a little earlier when you become a permanent resident. So what happens is that many a time we have someone who's interested in living in the United States or and doing business in the United States, but taxes really puts them off and they think, oh, I don't want to pay taxes. So what happens? How do people deal with this? Why are there so many millionaires in the United States who prefer to live here? Do they not pay lots of taxes? These are all issues that I really would like to discuss. And I don't know if we can do it in one podcast, Mark.
We'll try.
Well, today to help us, we have Clayton Cartwright.
That's right, Mona. Today we have Clayton Cartwright. Clayton is the founder and managing member of the Cartwright Law Firm based in Columbus, Georgia, which specializes in employee benefits and international taxation, which kind of makes sense why he's the guest for today's show, right? He advises on matters such as cross-border employee transfers, withholding and reporting requirements, permanent establishments, and a whole slew of other international taxation concerns. He is also a frequent speaker and author for immigration law seminars and practice guides. Clayton, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Clayton, so many millionaires around the world want to come to the United States. They want their children to be educated in the United States, but they're terrified of taxes. So this is an issue which comes up over and over again for us. I'm going to jump straight into it. If someone wants to come to the United States and they take the plunge, when do you think that they need to get a tax advisor who's proficient in the area involved?
Probably if they had a time machine before they actually decided they wanted to come to the United States. The U.S. has a citizenship-based tax system. The United States is one of two countries in the world that has citizenship-based taxation on worldwide income, along with Eritrea, the other one. So big surprise there. And then we tax on worldwide income on two other bases. The first one is permanent residence. I'm sure we're going to be diving in and talking a lot about permanent residence today. The third basis, in addition to citizenship and permanent residence, is substantial presence. And so,
well, those are all issues, Clayton, that I really want to go into.
Yeah.
So sorry to interrupt you there. Yeah. But my one big quick question is, you've mentioned citizenship-based and then permanent resident-based. Obviously, we do really want to clarify what that actually means.
Right, of course. I mean, citizenship-based, and for U.S. tax purposes, it's whatever your immigration lawyer tells you. It's when your immigration counsel, this is the one time that immigration and the tax lawyers will go and say, immigration lawyers, you have it. And it's an easy section to remember in the Internal Revenue Code. I don't like citing sections, but it's section one. Everyone remembers section one, right? It's the regulations on section one. Okay. And they've been in place for 53 years, for a very long time. And that is, as soon as you become a citizen, per the Immigration and Nationality Act, per U.S. immigration law, you are considered a U.S. citizen for income tax purposes. Easy.
And that Simple. Means you have to file taxes, even if you are 100 miles, you're working in 100 different countries, you're not working in the U.S., or you're not necessarily working for a U.S. company.
Right. That's exactly right. And the biggest issue there is the one that we deal with in terms of the term accidental American, someone who becomes a U.S. citizen by birth, but they're born abroad. For example, they've derived U.S. citizenship, you know, there, or perhaps they became a U.S. citizen by birth in the United States because they happened to be born here.
And they live somewhere else and they never, ever, ever pay taxes.
That's exactly. They never, ever filed in the U.S. And those individuals actually are in the U.S. tax net.
Gosh. Okay, so many of our clients, so EB-5 clients, what they often want to do is they don't want to be suspect to taxes. So they ask their wives to be the primary in an EB-5 petition, or their children alone to be a primary. Is that a way to avoid taxes for the maybe the person who really does pay the taxes?
Not really. I mean, the issue there is that wherever permanent residency attaches to an EB-5 petition, whoever has that green card here, they're going to be pulled into the U.S. tax net. And it's a pretty easy determination. You just look at on the green card itself, and it says resident since, and that's the date. Almost always when it comes to just pure permanent residence. And so, as a matter of fact, I had two consults today. I asked them to pull and said, where is your green card? Pull your green card out. Read me the date on your green card. That's an easy thing to do. Just look at the date on the green card there because that's going to be the case. It's not when you receive the green card. It is the date on the green card.
Well, we don't want to stop people coming to the United States, Clayton. So can you give us any words of wisdom? Why do we have so many millionaires in the country and billionaires? Surely these guys pay taxes and they must have methods of paying.
Sure. And so from the standpoint of international taxation, I mean, it's not just the U.S. And the U.S., when we're looking from the standpoint of high net worth individuals, we are not necessarily a high tax jurisdiction here. Particularly,
I think that's the key.
Right. And there is statutory tax relief that these individuals will receive, particularly the statutory foreign tax credit. So if you're paying foreign taxes, non-U.S. taxes in that jurisdiction, then you'll be allowed a credit on your U.S. return. So you're not paying double.
That's another very interesting thing.
Right.
So if you're being taxed in your own country, you're not going to be taxed again.
Well, you're going to pay the greater of the two. And so you're not going to pay country X plus the United States. You'll pay the greater of the two, country X or the U.S.
Okay, but that's a very important issue.
So it's not incremental. You don't pay if your country of origin is less, you don't pay that and then the surplus to the U.S. If the U.S. was the greatest, you'd pay the U.S. Or if your country of origin is greater, would you have to pay the higher country of origin or could you use the U.S.?
Well, I mean, the issue there goes to the type of income. And so if the income is sourced in country X has what we call primary jurisdiction to tax that income. And so what that means is that it's sourced in India or in China. China gets the first shot. China or India doesn't provide the relief. The U.S. does. And so when the U.S. pulls it in, if the U.S. rate is higher, then the U.S. will grant the full credit for all the tax paid in China or India. And then there'll be a delta that will be paid to the U.S. If the U.S. is less, then the U.S. tax is completely absorbed.
Oh, very interesting. So a lot of clients decide or opt not to get a green card and go for maybe an E2 petition or some other non-immigrant petition because they believe that on those type of petitions, they would not be subject to worldwide taxes. Is that correct?
In the great pantheon of tax gods, with great certainty, the answer is it depends. Because an E2 type petition is not permanent residency, but tax residency can be triggered by something called substantial presence. Uh-huh. And so if the individual is tax resident in the country where there is not an income tax treaty, then the person's time in the U.S. is pretty much capped at 182 days. Otherwise, if they spill over into 183 days, then they're going to be taxed per year. They're going to be tax resident in the United States. Irregardless.
So if somebody has a green card then and not necessarily a non-immigrant visa, that same definition would affect them also?
Well, they can be pulled into tax residency as well. But someone who has a green card, who is permanent resident in the United States, they're not going to be filing as non-resident in the U.S. They're going to be filing as resident in the U.S., declaring their worldwide income. The play on the E2 side is one where if they live in a country and they're resident in the country that doesn't have an income tax treaty, I've seen my high net worth clients travel with a book, a calendar, and they count the days that they're in the United States. They count them, they count them, they count them in order to make sure they stay below the 182 okay, here, because that is the maximum number. That is the maximum number that they could be in the United States and not be tax resident. And to be clear, Mona, when someone's not tax resident in the United States, it doesn't mean they're free of U.S. tax. It just means they're only taxed on amounts that are sourced in the U.S., okay, as opposed to worldwide.
So can a client who has, say, a U.S. citizen child and they've decided not to return to the United States, can that child be presumed abandoning her status if that child has, say, lived outside for 30 years and never paid taxes?
Ah, yes, the presumed abandonment, the de facto abandonment. So here, for U.S. tax law purposes, I think a good way to look at this is that the tax law is written by tax professionals and not by immigration lawyers. Okay, and so when the tax law looks at abandonment issues, they look at it objectively. And so the only time abandonment is triggered is when the individual actually formally abandons their permanent residency.
And when we talk about formally abandon, we're speaking of actually going through the formalities and filings and et cetera.
That's exactly right. You caught me before I was going to say the infamous term I-407, but that's the actual form that's filed.
And what about tax treaties? Can that help? Like foreign tax treaties with other countries?
Yes. And so, well, tax treaties, I have a love-hate relationship with tax treaties here. In other words, if someone's looking to maintain permanent residency, they dare not file, use a tax treaty and file as U.S. tax non-resident. The reason for that is that we have legacy guidance from 1996 from the old Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, that states that if you file a tax return using a treaty saying you're U.S. tax non-resident, you are presumed to abandon your lawful permanent resident status. Presumed. A presumption that can be overcome, but you don't want to counsel a client to do that.
Right.
And so if they're looking to maintain, the answer to that is no. If they're looking to abandon, if they're looking to abandon, oh, the tax treaty is my best friend. Indeed, to give you a really strong example, right now I have non-resident returns being filed for a client back 23 years.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, caught in that situation here. There are reasons to do that, but I'm probably too detailed for this podcast.
Well, that doesn't mean to say we won't have you back on, Clayton. So the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, or FACTA, which really ensures America's continued status as the preeminent financial secrecy destination. And this is one of the elements that we do often discuss when we are talking overseas about, as I said, the ease of doing business, getting immigration into the U.S. Well, very interested in your views on how FACTA works on a practical basis.
Sure. And so I have many clients who will come and say to me that I haven't filed tax returns for 20 years. I've been a lawful permanent resident overseas. And because of this FATCA, this new FATCA legislation, that I'm now required to file. FATCA is an enforcement mechanism.
That's correct.
It's enforcement only.
And it's an enforcement for almost every jurisdiction to basically declare what's in your bank statement, what's in your bank account.
Well, that's an enforcement on rules that are already in place. So the international tax provisions that apply to permanent residents, they've been in place for over 50 years. The requirement to file something called the Foreign Bank Account Report, what people might know as the FBAR, the FBAR, that's been in place since 1970, a very, very long time. The real driver, the real enforcement mechanism, the hammer, the anvil, whatever you want to call it, that is the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act that came in 2010 and gave some real heft to these provisions here. Otherwise, you know, before the era, the internet and big data, it was very difficult for the U.S. tax authorities to regulate these areas.
But the essentially, if you have, say, a few million sitting in a bank account in Switzerland, you have to declare it, or rather the banks will declare it. But if you have a few million sitting in a bank account in Delaware, you can use FACTA and suppress that information, correct?
Well, the few million with the account in Delaware, probably not disclosed. It's a domestic account, and you're absolutely right. So what you're talking about here is turning FATCA on its ear,
yeah,
right? The law of unintended consequences comes into full effect here because someone says, well, gee, I'm tax resident in the U.S., and I have to declare all my foreign accounts on this FBAR, on this FBAR. Well, that's fine. Then I'll just squirrel away in a domestic trust. I'll squirrel away in U.S. bank accounts. Now, of course, all of those are subject to disclosure, you know, to the U.S. authorities. You just don't have to blatantly do it on an income tax return or on a treasury filing.
So bearing in mind that so many people do utilize gifts, not just from parents, but from uncles, from brothers, from friends, we really want to ensure that all tax exemptions, everything has been utilized to make sure that the donee is not being taxed for this gift, which is utilized in the source of funds. Perhaps you could shed some light on this. Oh,
of course. The big key thing, and a common question that I can easily answer when these issues arise, is that the U.S. has a gift tax system, but it taxes the donor, not the donee. And so the question is does U.S. gift tax apply with the gift when we're dealing with source of funds? And the question is, there is typically the donor. It is not considered to be a resident for U.S. gift tax purposes. Now, that's a different concept.
That's a huge wow for so many attorneys I know who've just been filing these petitions.
Right. Well, right. And so the question there is the donor subject to U.S. gift tax? And if the donor is not a U.S. citizen, they typically are not. If they are not domiciled in the U.S., they typically are not. Then the question, then the gift is only taxable if the gift is a gift of U.S.-sited property, property deemed to be located inside the United States.
So if I happen to donate a gift of $500,000 cash, not property, to someone I know who wants to file for EB-5, would I be taxed?
Typically, no. General answer, no.
Because it's cash?
Because
I'm a donor?
No. It's because you are a non-citizen, non-resident donor who is giving cash, even if it's dollars. Dollars are considered to be intangible property. They are not subject a gift of dollars by a non-citizen, non-resident donor, not subject to U.S. gift tax.
But if I was giving an apartment, which is then subsequently sold, and those proceeds utilized for EB-5, that's taxable.
Exactly, because real property is considered to be inside the U.S. If there's an apartment in Manhattan that's gifted, that is considered to be a gift of U.S.-sided property. So it's all in the planning. A colleague of mine about 20 years ago said, it's not form over substance, it's form drives the substance. And so the question is, before you make the gift, to have the proper planning. I've answered this question in probably 2 minutes, but if the gift is already being made, it could take 2 years to unravel the consequences of a badly designed gift.
Gosh. So, Clayton, what about the clients who we have who decide they want to give the gift overseas, even if they're perhaps in the United States, but they manage it in such a way that the gift is given in a foreign country?
If it's non-U.S. sided property, there's no issue whatsoever, and that's with that same type of donor. Now, keep in mind, the gift won't be subject to U.S. gift tax. However, the donee probably will have to declare the gift to the U.S. on their income tax return. Okay, on their income tax return. But that is just a declaration. I can declare all day long. And the days before electronic filings, I like to say, you know, it's paper. If you don't like using too much paper, plant some more trees. I like trees, and now it's all electronic now, so I don't know. You know, put more sand on the beach, it's only more silica. I don't know. But the issue is there is just only disclosure. And so there's no real tax effect, income tax hit, or gift tax hit for disclosing this. But it is required, and the penalties for failure to actually disclose that can be substantial.
What are we talking about substantial?
Like in excess of $10,000.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so yeah, very substantial. This is not like nickel and dime type of penalties here. So, but again, it's just disclosure. And so it's very, very important, and maybe a very key thing and a basic fact is to have a tax preparer who is competent in these areas of international tax law. This is not something that the donee does in terms of income tax filings online by themselves. There's no self-preparation here. I know as immigration lawyers, you don't like self-filing. Tax lawyers and tax accountants don't like self-filing either. But it's also a matter that one doesn't take to a local tax service. You need a competent international tax accountant, probably backed up by a competent international tax lawyer. I think I know one who's sitting in my seat right now, for example, in order to advise on this. And the key is to catch this in advance. You know, it's very, very true that an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure.
Well, I agree. And it's interesting because there are some countries that we deal with, Brazil, for example, where gifting even cash to a child has tax consequences.
Right. You raise a very important point, and that is that when we're looking at the tax issues here, we just can't look at the U.S. side of things here. And often I have to engage with the other side here to make sure. So we recommend the gift. The gift can be completely free of U.S. gift tax here,
right.
But we have to look at the other jurisdiction to see, okay, is the gift going to trigger, what type of tax will the gift trigger in that jurisdiction here to make sure that we're free and clear in both jurisdictions here, or at least we've engaged in a worldwide minimization strategy.
Yeah. And I just want to point out, Clayton, that's why we are so happy to have you on this particular episode, because there's lots of domestic U.S. tax experts that can speak about the tax codes in the U.S., but there are very few international taxation experts, those that can not just look at the U.S. tax code, but also the other countries and countries of origins and things that would impact the taxation of the individual and their properties and their companies. And yeah, we're just so excited to have you on to explore these topics with us. Even knowledge on gift tax is a gift to us.
Thank you for that, Clayton. I'm sure we're going to discuss gift tax a lot more in the coming future. But the other issue that I really wanted to discuss with you is that we have a number of clients who are students. And for the first time, they've become U.S. citizens. They don't really have any income because they're students. It's whatever their father or the parents give them. And they have to file taxes whilst as a student. And for the first time also, we are seeing students who haven't yet received their green card being asked to file taxes.
Right. The issue there is that students, per the Internal Revenue Code, they are only considered tax resident based upon that substantial presence test that I mentioned. That's a day counting test. There are two versions of the test that I like to break it up into two chunks. Statutorily, it's one test, but I like to call it simple and complex. So let's do simple. 183 days in the U.S., you're a tax resident. Easy. And then there's a test that I call the complex test. If you take the current number of days in the year, and if that's at least 31, and you add one third of the previous year plus one sixth of the second preceding year, I always cringe when I hear this by my other speakers, but that's the test. And if that sum is at least 183 days, you're pulled in. Okay. Which is most students, except that we have for student visas, we have an exemption for counting days. And that exemption is for up to 5 calendar years. And that's part of calendar years. That's not anniversary date. That is, if you have to exempt on December 31st of 2019, that one day counts for 1 year. So for up to 5 calendar years, students don't have to count days, as long as they remain in compliance, substantial compliance with their visa.
And it's important to note out that filing taxes is important, but they don't necessarily pay taxes if you're a student, but you must file. The reason I ask this is because many of our clients who are EB-5 candidates are given a Schedule K from the project.
Right, exactly. And so it's important from that perspective to make sure that they're filing, because even though they don't have to count, for example, if they don't have to count those days, that doesn't mean they're exempt from U.S. taxation. That means they're tax non-resident taxable on U.S. source income only. Well, that K-1 that is received from the project is U.S. source income in terms of when they receive it.
So one of the biggest questions that clients ask us all the time is, will I be taxed on the $500,000 or now $900,000 that we are giving to the project? We are investing in the project. And will I be taxed on interest that the project gives to me?
The answer to that is yes. I mean, that's part of whether...
Well, you're not taxed on the investment, I believe.
Right. You're not taxed on, but you're taxed on the income that the investment is generating.
That's right.
And so no one's taxed on the actual basis or principle of the investment itself, but you are taxed on any income that's generated by the investment.
So if the project is giving you a return on investment of, say, 5% or 6%, you're going to be taxed on that.
Right. That is regardless of whether the individual is resident or non-resident in the U.S. for income tax purposes, because it will be U.S. source income to them.
Thank you, Clayton. I really want to let our listeners understand that taxation in the United States really isn't such a big deal, and continuing with your tax compliance is very doable, correct?
Right. And so I think the key is to get started early. Have competent advisors that are working for you here, and realize that it is a continual process, not a batch processing issue here where you look at it every few years. It requires constant maintenance here, but at a very low level. So as long as you have the advisors who are working for you here, realizing that you know, you have a series of tax treaties. You have foreign tax credits to deal with. There's lots of disclosure, but disclosure is disclosure here. I mean, no one's taxed on disclosure. And as long as you properly make disclosure, you're not going to be penalized. And so if you keep that going on a continual track here and not let it linger or languish, then there shouldn't be as big of an issue as one would see.
Yes, definitely excellent advice. So start early, get the right advisors, Clayton, you sound like a good advisor. And it's a continuous process as tax laws change, as people change. You know, keep up with it, continuous process. Clayton Cartwright, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.